The topic of the Aguna crisis is a very controversial topic. New York, you cannot open a Jewish newspaper without some discussion on almost a weekly basis. In fact, it's so controversial, my wife said to me, you know, maybe talk about something less controversial. I explained to you that this is contemporary controversies. It's the topic. You can't come and say, you know, what bracha do you make on grapes? And it's not going to sell. The Aguna crisis, as it's called, goes a little bit like this. The word Aguna means chained, as in chained woman. Traditionally, throughout history, the title was given to a woman whose husband went missing. What would happen is, before we had modern forms of communication, a man would go off to war, a man would go off to business, and he would just never come back, and we would never hear from him again. Right? There wouldn't be any message that he died, nothing. The person would just disappear. The person would go off on a boat trip, we'd expect to see them in 6 months from now. 6 months would go by, seven, eight, a year, 2 years, and the fellow would just never come back. And every so often you'd have someone come from another area and say, do you know anything? And that woman was an aguna. Aguna means that she was stuck. On the one hand, she wasn't a widow, because we have no proof that the man has died. On the other hand, she's not divorced. So one way or the other, she cannot move on with her life. And so, but to say that she's married is also not true, because she does not have a husband to support her. So this woman is stuck. Thankfully, communication technology has picked up. That rarely happens nowadays, that someone will just absolutely positively go missing. We rarely have a case like that. Therefore, the title of Aguna was taken over by a different situation. The situation is a case which is something that really happened throughout history rarely, but it's becoming more prevalent now, is as follows. That a couple will live together, and for whatever reason, they will decide that they are getting divorced. And the husband will use the get, the divorce document, as a bargaining chip. And say, unless you agree to the following, you give me a fair amount of money, or that you give me custody of the children, or whatever else I happen to demand, unless you agree to this, I will not give you a divorce document, and then you will not be able to get remarried. And the question is, what to do with these fellows? Obviously, this is inappropriate. It's halachically wrong. It's not something that we support at all. The question is, what can we do possibly to avoid these situations, to get out of these situations, etc. Again, a lot of this has to do with the current day legal system. It used to be that if a man and a woman decided to get divorced, they went to the rabbi's study, they say that we want to get divorced, the rabbi would sit with them, are you sure this is what you really want? And that would be it. And he'd write the divorce document, that would be the end of it. Now, of course, the lawyers got involved. Once you have lawyers involved, you have people advising, what can you do to better your situation? And again, tactics like this, which are clearly not proper, happen on both sides, right? Lawyers of women in divorce will oftentimes advise him, claim that he's abusing you, claim that he's abusing the children, even though it's patently false, with the thought being that if she makes a claim of abuse, no judge would have the guts to say, I don't believe you. She will then get custody, at least temporary custody and restraining order against the husband. During that time, she can speak to the children. Whenever he does send a birthday gift, she throws it out. And then when it comes time to the court case and say, which parent do you want to stay with? Of course, the children who have lived with this for months will say, why do I want him? So again, this use of unscrupulous tactics is not solely the area of the men in divorces. It's also very prevalent in women as well, unfortunately. And this happens largely because people are advising them to do this. You know? If you want child custody, take my advice. This is how you're going to get it. If you want X, Y, and Z, I'll tell you how to do it. And it's normal. People do it. It happens all the time. That's a lot of the problem. So the question is, what can we do to stop this? Now, so let's play things out. Couple comes to a bais din. Right? The Gemara has the following case. You have a situation of a couple where one of these spouses is not living up to their obligations, right? Spouses have obligations in a marriage, right? They have obligations to, a husband has to make a living, right? The woman has to help out around the house, take care of the children, right? They have conjugal relations with one another. What if one of these spouses says, I'm not doing it anymore? I refuse to. So, the Mishnah tells us that it's the job of the bais din to sit down and to figure out what's going on. Right? In the event, for example, the husband isn't going to work, he's not providing, the number one goal of the Beis Din is to get the guy off his tochus and to get him to start providing, right? To make things better, right? Obviously, already, a woman is entitled to a ksuba, right? A certain amount of money at the end of the marriage. If the man is not doing what he's supposed to do, they have the right to add to the value of that. Conversely, if she's the one who's not listening, they have the right to subtract from that. And therefore, obviously the goal in any case, first and foremost, is to fix the problem. Whatever the problem is, I have this issue with my husband, I have this issue with my wife, the Beis Din sits down. If it's a reasonable problem, you sit down with the offending party and say, listen, you know, this is not good, this is what has to be done. However, the Gemara says, what if you have a different case? The woman shows up and says, I've got no problem with him. But ma'usalai, I find him disgusting. I just can't live with him anymore. You know? As the old saying goes, it's not you, it's me, I just hate you. Right? That's what it is. You know, there's nothing to be done. You know, we've lost that loving feeling, or we never had that loving feeling. And my father made me marry him, and I tried to make it work, and it's just not working. What happens at that point? Now, obviously, there's nothing to fix. You can't turn around and say, "Well, just stop being so disgusting, will you, guy?" And you know, if there's specific reasons. You know, sits in his underwear and he watches football games while drinking beer every Sunday, you know, and he doesn't pick up his underwear and he leaves them on the floor. And okay, you know, we can go down the list, we can do some therapy, we can do some counseling, you know. We can perhaps try to work on this. However, with the comment just is, forget it. You know, the Mishnah says that the Beis Din has a right to turn around and tell him, okay, you have to divorce her. Now, of course, you've got a feel for the other guy, right? Right? The fellow here, you know, he came into this and we assume that he's trying to make it work. She just doesn't love him anymore. So therefore, you know, he doesn't have to pay the ksuba, she has to give back the gifts, you know, it all goes back. But since there's nothing more we can do to help here, what we have to do is we have to tell him, you've got to give a divorce. The divorce is kofin also. We force him to give a divorce. Now, that would seem to be the answer to all the world's questions. If there comes a point where the marriage is over, right, it's not savable anymore. They've been through therapy, they've gone through everything, they're trying to work it out, but you know, it's just not working. You know, they have irreconcilable differences has been determined, and therefore it's time to both move on. So it would seem that that would be the equivalent of the case if the woman says, I just don't love him anymore. And therefore the Beis Din should be able to force a get. The Beis Din should be able to turn around and say, listen, you have to divorce her. Now, divorce is somewhat like marriage in the way it happens. Two people. But beyond that, so how ring? Well, they're not married, right? This is a consensual agreement. Right? This is both parties have to agree. If he doesn't really want to marry her, you can't force it. If she doesn't want to marry him, you can't force her. It is something that's done with the agreement of both of them. However, the actual act is initiated by the husband. Right? She doesn't come and say, listen, I'd like you to marry me. He offers the ring to her. Similarly, divorce happens the same way. The man comes with a document of divorce and says, I'm hereby handing you the document of divorce. She accepts that document and they are divorced. Much like by marriage, you can't have one performing a marriage on the other one without the other's agreement. Similarly, you can't have that either by divorce. Both parties have to be in agreement. Now, let's take another case. Let's say there's a guy who's been dating a girl. It's been like 3 years and the parents are going crazy already. So the father, being a good father, shows up one day with a shotgun and says, congratulations, you're getting married right now. And he would take a ring with the gun to his head, literally, and offer her the ring to marry her. And she accepts. Are they married?
Yes.
So no. Because he did not consent to this. What?
Somebody had to answer.
That's right. And Patty, thank you. You're always there. So if you put a gun to the guy's head and he would give her the ring, or if he put a gun to her head to accept the ring, right? This was not the consensual agreement that we spoke about, right? Therefore they are not married. Similarly, if you put a gun to the horse, that's not going to work either. So the question is, well, what does it mean we have now decided you have to divorce your wife? The rule is, there's something called a get me'usa, a forced get. And a forced get doesn't work. Right? Just like a forced marriage wouldn't work, a forced divorce doesn't work.
I thought you forced until he says, Rosa.
So, there's a famous opinion of the Rambam. Everybody knows this Rambam. The Rambam asks the question, and he says, I don't understand. How is this allowed? So he says, what's happening here is you're beating the guy. And when he says, okay, I'm going to do it by my own free will, we believe him. Why do we believe him? Because down deep, everybody wants to do good. And just, you know, we have the evil inclination, the Yetzer Hara is around us, so we beat it out of him. Right? And therefore, many people talk about this in different, outside the topic of divorce, they talk about it that really down deep, we're all good people. You just need to beat it out of us sometimes. That's a lovely thought, and we do not follow it at all. The Rambam is a minority opinion that was ultimately rejected. So because of that, this well-known thought is not very helpful to us. So the discussion is, when can you force somebody to divorce their wife? Again, it's the same. Just like you can have a situation, of course, there are situations where the marriage is over.
She needs her consent again.
Yes, absolutely. So there's one major difference. Not a major difference, obviously. It rarely makes a difference. The big difference between a woman not having a get and a man not having a get is purely biblical. According to the Bible, a man can have two wives. And a woman cannot have two husbands. So, on a biblical level, if a man refuses to give a get, the woman is stuck. However, on a biblical level, if a woman refused to accept a get, well, that's fine. He could just take a second wife. Now, the reason that this isn't very relevant is because this is on the biblical level. Famously, Rabbeinu Gershon, many, many years ago, came up with his decree, which has been accepted across all of Israel at this point, that we no longer allow men to have two wives, A. And a second part of it was that you cannot force a woman to accept a get. Now, there's a question, what does that mean? Now again, the fact that he said you're not allowed to have two wives indicates that before that you were allowed to have two wives. Can I make the same logical step that just you can no longer force a woman to accept a get? Does that mean that you were allowed to beforehand? So the answer is no. For all you people nodding yes, right? Because there are a slew of these takanos, edicts of Rabbeinu Gershon. Another one that's probably the third best known one is that you're not allowed to read someone else's mail. Now does that
condition before the issue of
What? So that's not true.
The Gemara doesn't say that?
No, the Gemara doesn't mean that. What do you think? Right? The idea being that in the event that she would accept it, perhaps there were certain cases where it would make a difference. But the bottom line is at the end of the day is that a man cannot have two wives now, and a man cannot force a woman to accept a get. Right? So therefore, for all practical intents and purposes, men and women are on a level playing field. Right? The women on a biblical level, right? The men on a rabbinical level, but both of them, if their spouse will not go forward with the divorce proceeding, basically are just as stuck. There's one exception, which is really not a big exception, but like all small exceptions, if you wanted to, you could run an elephant through it. It goes a little bit like this. There are situations where a man will want to effectuate a divorce, and really, despite the fact that she is not agreeing, we would want it to go through. I've only been involved in two of these cases, and it basically was a case like this. For example, if the woman has early onset Alzheimer's, and therefore she does not have the mental capacity forever. He'll put money away in escrow to make sure that she's always taken care of. He's not abandoning her, but there's a need to go on here. In that case, there is a provision for what's called the heter meir avonah, meaning that when they originally set up these edicts that men cannot remarry, they said if there's a very extreme case, then in such a situation, if 100 rabbis from three different countries, basically, agree, then we can allow the man to remarry. A little unclear what we're doing there. Some opinions is, you know, we're going to give her a get despite the fact that she's not understanding it, or are we allowing him to take a second wife? Right? It's technicalities as to how it works, but the bottom line is, in that case, we allow you to go forward. It's interesting that back in the day, 100 years ago, every city had one rabbi, and to pull together 100 rabbis was no mean feat. So famously, the Sri Deish said that it doesn't have to be 100 rabbis, it just be 100 Talmidei Chacham, 100 wise men. The joke is, that was terrible. Now to get 100 rabbis, that's no problem. 100 people know something. And that's no mean feat at this point. Right? So you have that out for men, which women don't have. Now that is a case that should only be used very sparingly. And I've been involved basically for a bunch of years now. Two cases that I know of. However, if you're going to deal with people that are unscrupulous, who knows what can happen? Now, there's a question like, where do you draw the line? Let's say, for example, a man and woman are married, and the woman decides, as long as she's married, she's violating one of the Ten Commandments. Were she to be divorced, this wouldn't be better, but at least this would make it spiritually easier on her. Right? She's not a married woman anymore, cheating on her husband. So would we support, in that case, using this mechanism, since ultimately it's for her good as well? And she might not appreciate it. So that's like, and the question is, how far are you going to take it? But it's something that's out there on one side and not the other, and that's really the only imbalance we're talking about. Yes?
That would be a big difference between whether the heter avonah is making her divorce or just allowing the debt to marry someone else.
Correct. Absolutely. So, there you have it. So you have this setup where the mission indicates there are times where kofim, we force him to give a get. And the question is, to what extent can we use this power in a case where a person is just being unreasonable? Or worse, to force the person to give a get. There are several issues involved. In the Shulchan Aruch, they quote this idea, the Ramah, who the Ashkenazim follow, starts off by saying, you've got to be really, really careful with this. Why? Because in many situations where a woman will come forward and say, no, I've lost that loving feeling, where she wants to walk out on him and he'll start life afresh. So, should we be forcing him to give a get in that case? Or when she took her vows, did she say, you know, sickness and health till death do us part?
No.
No, she didn't say it?
No.
Were you there?
She didn't say it. The Jewish wedding. She didn't say
that. Then by the power invested in me, you didn't have that part. Okay, so people didn't say that. But the idea is even if we don't say it, right? The idea is there, right? Just like a man shouldn't be allowed to walk away from the marriage because he feels like it, of course he thinks he's got a better offer elsewhere. Similarly, the woman should not be allowed to walk away from the marriage because, you know, things haven't gone, because he didn't turn out to be the Prince Charming she was hoping for. So that's the first good question is, when are you going to meet the criteria? You know, it's very hard to tell. Because just because a woman walks in and says the magic words, mo, salai, maybe she doesn't understand the words you were just told to say it. You know, to what extent? And what if he claims that, no, I want to stay married there. I still love her. I know we can work this out. It's just a rough patch. So, theoretically, we'd like to give him a chance, but do we believe him? Is this a ruse? Is he living in a dream world? Is this impossible? And you know, it's very difficult. I had a case very recently in the Beis Din, where the woman came forward, she wanted a divorce. 50 to 75 other women in his neighborhood, including the Rebbe, who was on the list. What a great world we live in. But he wants one more chance. Now, I would have laughed it off if it wasn't for the fact that after this happened, she took her back in. She did give her another chance. This wasn't enough to convince her that it was time to move on. So, it's very hard in these cases. So that's problem number one. To come with a case that's solid is difficult. Now, why do I care so much if it's solid? Do I care so much because of this? Right? As I said earlier, if a man gets married or a woman gets married because someone puts a gun to their head, they're not married. If a man or a woman gets divorced because someone puts a gun to their head, they're not divorced. So what's going to happen here? I'm going to force this guy to give a get. Right? In the event that this was the wrong call by me, it's not just like Yom Kippur, I'm going to have to clap a few more times, but they're not divorced. And if she gets remarried, she's not married to the new husband, she's married to the old husband. And if they have children, the children are mamzerim. So the stakes are really high here. Because if you force someone to give a get when it's not appropriate, you're not doing the other person a favor. That's problem number one. So the when to do it is big. Number two, store. Right? You know, everyone should stop doing business with it. There's communal pressure. Right? You know, you're not getting aliyahs anymore. How far do we go with pressure? So the Rambam, as Sam mentioned, famously lets it all ride. Beat the heck out of him until he gives it. And there are parts of the Jewish community that support that. Not only not halachically, but in policy they do. There's been known cases of people who didn't want to give their wives get, particularly in certain Hasidic communities, where they take the guy and they hang him by his feet over the overpass of the BQE, and they say, are you sure you don't want to give your wife a get? You better say so because my nose is getting an itch and I have to scratch them. And not surprisingly, these people see the light very quickly. But the question is, if that's not an appropriate form of forcing, if the guy's only giving a get because he's hanging over the overpass and the car, the trucks are zipping down below him, there's a possibility that this was worthless, that you've accomplished nothing. I'll just note for the record, if they actually do drop him, then there's no problem. Then she can definitely remarry, whether he wanted to be dropped or not. That, in fact, would work. Just theoretically. So, that is one level. Another level.
He's liable for his death at that point.
Or the truck to hit him, I imagine.
How many people would drop them?
Well, are you talking legally or halachically?
Go on.
Okay. Legally, they all look alike. They never get caught. That's how this works, by the way. Yeah, put five of them on the line and pick up the right one. No problem. So, that's one approach. Another approach is, you know, get his dad fired. Get his kids thrown out of school. There's ways you can put significant pressure on people without it. And the question is, which level of pressure is appropriate? So, for example, Rabbeinu Tam came up with a series of rules of what to do with these types of people. So he thought that what one should do is, you can't beat them up. He thought that would be halachically problematic. However, what you can do is you can have a series of communal laws. For example, as long as someone's not giving his wife a get at the time the basin has told him to, we will not circumcise his children. We will not bury any of his family members. And so you took issue with that. Some people said, okay, that's far enough. That's just too far. Because, you know, here you know, you get his mother lying dead and she's not going to be buried until he comes forward, you know. So that's the second issue of how far is one allowed to go. And the third issue that one has to deal with is who's allowed to do it. The Mishnah says that if the Gentile neighbors decide that this is a bad thing And Big Vinny grabs the guy by the neck and says, you know, I hear you're not giving your wife a get. I think it'd be a darn good idea. That gets for sure not good. There are further issues with what if the basin hires Vinny, then it might be better. Right? But if Vinny is Jewish, better still. But those are the three issues. Moshe definitely calls for this. Right? If you put it all together, you end up with a lot of cases that are still not covered. So, over recent history, various proposals have been offered that could perhaps be helpful. One of the earlier ones is that when people get married, they should get married only conditionally. That, you know, I hereby agree to marry you. However, if at some point, you know, you withhold a get, therefore from this day on, I'm not accepting I was ever married to you. Or you can do this the reverse. At the chuppah, you give her the ring, and then you give her her bill of divorce, conditionally. That, but if necessary, it will pay. Photo op, more kibbutim. Big sell. What? He says as follows. He's pointing that there are many problems with it. It's not that simple. So, for example, if a man divorces his wife, right, and then they live together afterwards, again, man gives his wife a get on January 1st. And the get will come into effect, it's supposed to say, on June 1st. And then in February, March, they're living together as husband and wife. Now, when it comes into effect retroactively, which means they weren't married as they were living together as husband and wife. The assumption is people don't want that to be happening. People want to be married when they're living with their spouses. So therefore, the assumption is, so practically that's not going to work. Similarly, the same idea. You don't want to wipe out the marriage from the beginning. So the assumption is that even if at some later point you say, no, I'd rather that I was never married and living in sin all this time and have to deal with this, still that's not going to work because at the time, that's probably not what you want. So that idea is, we kicked around, didn't really work. Another idea, which got a fair amount of press in its day, but not so much anymore, was this idea of annulments. Right? So many things we can learn from the church. What was the idea with annulments? Annulments are as follows, that when I married you, obviously you withheld information from me, and had I known that information, I would never agree to it. So for example, you have a situation of, let's say, a woman knows that she's sterile. And she marries a man without ever telling him this. So, if it's reasonable that had the man known this, he would have never agreed to marry her, one could annul the marriage. That the deal that was made when he gave her the ring was done with improper information. Now, this doesn't mean that if a man and a woman get married and then they find out later on that one of them can't have children, that there's a possibility to annul the marriage. No, because no one was withholding information in that case. Right? Things just didn't turn out the way you wanted it to. It's obviously has to be withholding information that you had at the time. So, the divorce document. Now, the idea of wiping out a marriage based on what's called fiducia totis, meaning that there was imperfect knowledge at the time, is really based on the same as any other monetary agreement. Right? I buy stock in Enron. The people in Enron knew, but they didn't tell me. Had I known that the whole thing was a sham, I would have never bought it. Therefore, I have a right to go to court and collect money from them. Right? Had they had the information which they had, which they should have made public, been made public, this deal would have never happened, and therefore, clearly I overpaid. Therefore, I am entitled to getting my money back. Right? That's the argument. I can't make the following argument. You know, I bought stock in BP and it went down. Had I known it was going to go down, I would have never bought it. So please give it back, my money back. Obviously, that's how business works. Business goes that, again, you're entitled to a certain amount of information. Assuming you have that information, you're going and you're gambling. You understand that whenever you buy a stock, there's a possibility it could go up and there's a possibility it could go down. obviously you believe that there's a better chance it's going to go up than down, so you're buying it, you're shorting it, you're thinking the opposite. But you always understand that there's a possibility that, you're wrong. There's not such a demand for alpacas. Who knew? Like, that's what happens in life. So therefore, obviously, if I was in the Beis Din and the two fellows come forward and say, you know, he sold me shares for this and it went down, and I thought it would go up, obviously we would not grant him monetary damages for this.
In life,
not everything works out. Now, that means you might have to get divorced. It might mean that you're going to have to... he's not Prince Charming, she's not Princess Charming. You know, he's not Ken, she's not Barbie. Whatever, fill in whatever you want. But... he's not Superman, she's not Wonder Woman, the comics. But whatever it is, at the end of the day, you know, you can't say that this should be annulled. You can't turn around and say, oh, you know, they withheld information. Now, what type of information is information? Everybody here who's married knows that in the first week of marriage, you find something out about your spouse that you never knew before. Had I known that she squeezed the toothpaste from the top of the thing instead of the bottom, I would have never been involved in this. Ha! Who squeezes the toothpaste from there? I gotta get the stuff back up. Obviously, it's not a strong argument that we would never got married had I been privy to this information. I should know he snores. I buy that. Again, in most cases, you know, the marriage isn't working out. We're very sorry about it. But to say that there was some latent information that the person was aware of that they withheld that was so serious that obviously no, there good reasons they would have not gotten married had they known about this, that's really a very, very rare case. Especially nowadays. People don't meet for the first time in the chuppah. It's rare. And if you have a Beis Din that is regularly finding this, and a very, very high percentage of their cases, one would have to be wary about this Beis Din. So at one point that this was popular, there were one or two Beis Dins that were regularly telling the women, you know. And of course, once you do this, by the way, it also opens up the floodgates. Man and woman are married. Man and woman are unhappy. Man and woman are getting divorced. Man readily gives a get. Woman dates again. She meets a Kohen. A divorced woman can't marry a Kohen. However, a woman that was never married before can. Goes forward, now goes for the annulment. Right? No, she's only with one man. Just because a woman lives with a man out of wedlock doesn't make her usher to a Kohen. So... right. Once we've opened up the gates for the annulment courts, right? Works in England, doesn't it? Yes, yes. The king wants to get remarried, no divorce. Done and done.
In the church.
There you have it. Start a new one. So obviously this is problematic. Other attempts that have been more mainstream. In 1983, New York State passed what was known as the Gett Law. Only in New York did this happen. Under this, the rules of the Gett Law, basically that meant, listen, buddy, if you're not giving her a get, don't think you're getting off and marrying this other woman. Because if it's bigamy by the Jews, it's bigamy by us also. Now, that was a very kind of the state to step in. Probably wasn't coincidence that Shelley Silver, the Speaker of the Assembly, is a graduate of YU, an Orthodox Jew, and a good man. And this law gets passed and signed into law in the state of New York. People liked it, but it was limited in how helpful it was. Because the guy didn't want to get divorced. Doesn't mean anything. So that paved the way for the 1992 Gett Law. Gett Law Part 2. One of the rare cases where perhaps, you know, the sequel was better than the first. And it went a little bit like this. Under the 1992 version of the Get Law, the judges in family courts have a right to take into account, when doing the equitable division of assets, whether one of the parties is limited in their ability to remarry. So what that does is as follows. Woman wants to get, she's applying for divorce. The man, in turn, says, however, the question is it too effective? We said earlier on that a get that is forced is not valid. And we said, well, what does force mean? Force means being in the matter of the poll, but anything less than that is okay. Or even taking away the money. And I'll go a step further, as many people did. What if I turn to him and I say, you know, in the event that you don't give this get, realize that there's this book on the law, this law on the books. So, does threat of coercion already make it problematic? Or how about even better than that? Let's say we're a couple in Denver, and unfortunately we're getting divorced. And one of the couple knows, you know, I can somehow get my forum to be New York. The fact that the husband realizes the wife can get the case moved to New York, is that enough of a threat? And if it does, this casts a pale, a shadow over many divorces. Right? It argues, not only in the cases where it's affected, but one could argue any state, any get in the state of New York, right, is questionable because the man understood that were he not to give the get, this would happen. And if one wanted to go even further, anybody who could any way get the case into New York, which is not that hard to do, that too, right? The woman just moves to New York and claims residence. So does that, people said, wait a second, this is making more trouble. And it's interesting because, I can tell you, at least in the Northeast, not just in New York, judges have become sensitive to the issue. If you're a divorce judge, you live in a community where there are a fair amount of observant Jews, you become aware of this, and therefore they've tried to expand the idea. I once got one of the craziest phone calls. The guy calls me up, he says, is the divorce lawyer, you'd like to hire me as an expert witness? I said, what am I an expert in? He said he needs me to be an expert in the ksuba. He wants me to come down and testify in court that nothing in the ksuba says that the man is forced to give again. That is true. There is nothing that does say it. So I said to him, okay, but why am I, what's going on in this case? He tells me the following story, that he is representing a man who's involved in a divorce case with his wife, and he very much wants to go to Beis Din, but she doesn't want to go. Said she went to court, and she got granted $1.3 million in alimony a year, which is absurd, because he only makes $800,000 a year. How can he possibly pay it? So he said, no, this is all wrong. We have to go to Beis Din and work everything out there, right, or else I'm not giving the gift. She responded by hiring someone to break his thumbs. Now, that was particularly important because he's a surgeon. Now, it ends up that the person that she hired is actually an amazing and says, okay, mister, you have to give a get. And the guy said, no, I don't. He said, because this isn't the state of New York. You don't have this law here. And the guy says, well, you're contractually bound because you, in fact, gave her the ktuba, which said that you agreed in the event that the dissolution of the marriage, you'll give a get. And he said, it doesn't say that at all. He said, so prove it. So we'd like you to come back and testify for this. So I told them, this doesn't sound right. Something, yes. So I got the background. I told him, I said, listen, I'll be honest with you. I'll testify that. But if they ask me, does the husband have a religious duty to give a get? So I'll say yes. And they said, 1 second. Put me on hold. And suddenly this rabbi comes on the phone to tell me that, no, he doesn't have to, because they just rattled off Myron McComas. I said, yo, buddy, if you're so smart, you go testify. I have my opinion, you have your opinion. Clearly they know you. You go testify. Well, I said, this is what I'm telling you. If I testify, this is what I say. You want it? You got it. So instead, they knocked me out, and they brought in a guy from Israel to testify who would say what they wanted to say. She, in turn, flew to Israel and sued the guy in Israel for perjury, for testifying to this, which was clearly not true, and made his life tremendously miserable. Right? So judges want to use whatever they can to expand upon it. The get law, in terms of being effective, yes, it is effective in some cases. On the other hand, the problem is it too effective? That's the issue that's out there. That's what a lot of people are talking about. You know, do you really, if they actually use the get law, that's a problem. The last attempt, which is, yes.
What about, I understand that we're trying to discover whether that's undue pressure. Mm-hmm. But everybody's actions have consequences. So he gets to make a choice.
Well, your money or your life is a choice also.
Say again?
Your money or your life.
Well, we're not saying your life. We're saying your money or give or get.
Your money or your wife.
Oh, your wife, sorry.
I just switched to life.
I'm saying, you know, there are consequences for everything you do and you don't do. You have consequences. And he has a choice. What's wrong with that?
Right. The question is, though, you know, your money or your life, you have a choice also.
This is it.
Right?
I don't want to do the dance stuff again.
We've been down this road too often?
We have.
Okay. But there it is. Right? So that's the issue here.
But why is that considered undue pressure?
Again, well, take away all your money unless you do this. That sounds like significant pressure. I can hear the argument.
Yes, well, again, but you're hanging her up. That's her life.
What? She married him. I wasn't the one to marry him.
She's trying to get out of being married.
Just then she's trying to get out of being married.
So why should she be penalized?
So again, on the other hand, so the question is that, you know, divorce is like marriage. Both parties have to be willing to do it.
So just in the realm of controversy, we're like, so clear that they should merge it to give again. We always hear about different sides. What could possibly be a side to
the cabana boy.
Encourage a guy.
Let's go back to the
cabana
boy.
Okay, we all know where there are frum women out there. We're not talking about the cabana boy situation. Frum women out. Why in the world is there anybody?
How are you defining frum?
Okay. A decent female. It doesn't have to be anything. Who cares? She doesn't want to be married to him anymore.
So again,
she's not cheating with anybody else.
Right.
Let's just leave it at that. She doesn't want to be married to anyone.
And so again, so
she doesn't like his pinky toe.
Doesn't like the fact he has cancer. Doesn't want to deal with it.
Which I'd say might not be so different than your Alzheimer's case, but okay. So I want you to just work through that one, because that's, I think, is the situation we always hear about.
Right. And again, and you have the situations on both sides. He doesn't want to be married to her anymore.
Okay, fine.
So the idea being that, you know, marriage is a consensual act. You go into it together, you come out of it together. You know, and just because one of them is ready to move on doesn't necessarily mean that the other one has to.
Right, but I guess the situation just comes up all the time. We hear that, you know, when one side has a whole community of people around them supporting them, not giving or accepting the gift. How is that religiously acceptable?
So again, not everything that gets done is religiously acceptable. Let's give an example. So there have been situations where pressure has been put on the man where he really should be giving it. Right? There was a general agreement in the days, and it made it clear that, listen, buddy, it's time to move on. And we're going to put pressure on you. So for example, while you have, more or less, and what they do is, let's say, a man's not giving a get, and there has been a psak, a decision of the Beis Din, that in fact he should give a get. They will go down, they'll protest. They'll protest in his place of work. You know, don't shop here because there's a guy here who's not going to do it. Right? They'll protest in front of his house, and they'll just generally make his life miserable. That's what?
How is that more
so, yeah. So there's two things that are different here. Two or three things, actually, that are different. The first one is, again, there are levels of pressure. And the question is, there's a certain pressure you have to put on, right? There is, the highest level is being that kind of thing, right? Right? Your money or your life. The second one,
In Israel,
that's...
Most of the cases, they just...
Sit.
Sit.
Right. Maybe because they're Israelis. I don't know. But that is not uncommon. Absolutely in Israel. Okay? Next level is we'll take away your money. And then the lower level is we'll make your life miserable. We're not going to take your money. Right? We're not going to. But we're going to put, you know, strong communal pressure against you. Right? Whether it's you're not going to let you in the shul. Right? We're not going to bury. Whatever it is. That's a third level. So that's one difference. A second difference is there's a difference between a case where a Beis Din has made a decision. This person has to give a get. And in the case of the get law, where there is no Beis Din involved in the process, it's the judge who's making the decision. He's well, he's healthy, but the guy gets up late, and he goes to the bar, and he doesn't go to work, and now look at this, I've got all these kids, and and no one's taking care of them. So what's the Beis Din going to do now? I'm going to call the guy in and say, listen, you got to get a job, you got to start making a living, you got to do this. And if you don't do that, what? Can Beis Din slap him around? So there's a strong argument that can be made that the Beis Din in that case can really pressure the guy. Right? They can use the full force. You know, financially, they can beat him up. They can do whatever they want to do with him. Now, of course, if this guy would give a get, the Beis Din would stop forcing him. Right? Because if a guy wants to be a lowlife and not work for a living and have a good time. It's only when he's married and has a family that we care about this. If the guy would give her a get and walk around and now would like to continue his antics, right, I don't think we'd have a problem with that. And then when he comes around the chakras to collect, we might tell him to get a job, buddy. But so that's a situation where you're putting on pressure, but you're not putting on pressure give a get. You bring on pressure, fix this. If he decides to fix it by giving a get, that's not necessarily a fraud. Now, let's go to the case of Israel and the courts, right? Right? There is a decision by the courts, you have to do this. He doesn't. What gives them the right to put him in jail? Contempt. You're in contempt of court. There's no law in the Israeli books that have to be put in jail. So the question is, what is that? Is that we are pressuring him to listen to the court, or are we pressuring him to give a get? In some cases, it gets really close.
Right, you're pressuring him to give a get.
Right? So in the case of Ora, we're pressuring the guy to listen to a court decision, which also might be a difference than the get law. So these cases are not necessarily the same. The last attempt, which is gaining momentum, is the prenuptial agreement. Prenuptial agreements go a little bit like this. It is understood that when a man gets married, he is obligating to support his wife. What does support mean? Feed her, clothe her, and put a roof over her head. Now, there's actual dollar value to this, right? How much does it cost for a woman to eat 3 meals a day? Hey, what would it cost for a hotel room? Hey, what would it cost for normal clothing? How much would that come out to a day? Anybody? Right, obviously it depends on the place. Depends on...
$200
a day. Right? Reasonable number. We'll accept it. But the prenuptial agreement does this as follows. The man says, I hereby obligate to pay my wife $200 a day for as long as we're married. It's under my roof and eating from my fridge and buying clothing with my credit cards. Obviously, I don't have to pay this $200 a day. Only if at some point we stop living under the same roof, etc., then it kicks in. So, what you have there is a situation where if the couple separates, then there's this obligation to pay $200 a day. $200 a day is $1,400 a week. It's $6,000 a month. It's $73,000 a year. And as long as this guy's holding out, there is this document, which is both halachically and legally binding, which he keeps on ticking. Every day you don't give a get, that's another $200. Now, this skirts many of the issues. For starters, who's forcing him to do it? Well, he's forcing himself.
Yeah, it's prenup.
Prenup, right? Right? The power that's forcing him is that he did it to himself. B, this is a legal obligation. This isn't a random number. He is still married to her. He is the husband. He is required to provide for his wife. And as such, we're not saying, because you're not giving it again. No. We're just saying that, okay, take your time, think it over, but as you do, realize that as long as you're married to this woman, you got paid. If somehow you stop being married to her, well, then you don't got to pay anymore. So that's the idea behind the prenup. Now, the prenup could be very successful. Now, there are two cases in particular where it's not going to work. A, if the guy's very rich, or B, if the guy's very poor. If he's very rich, $73,000, right? If he's very poor, so sue me. I don't got any money. I'm suit-proof. However, and let's say the 90% of the cases in between, this would seem to be a very useful type of document. There are questions as to how enforceable are these things in court, right? Time will tell on that. But it's a pretty good document. It's notarized, etc. It's updated as court decisions come down. So that's the idea behind it, that hopefully this prenup agreement, assuming that people sign off on it, right, is a way that is halachically not going to mess up the get. It's not going to hurt her in the long run. At the same time, it's going to add the pressure. Yes?
I don't want to preempt what you're talking about. Has there ever been a discussion about changing the mitzvah?
So, to say what?
I don't want to put myself on record, but something to the effect that should...
We can turn off the tape.
Okay. Something to that effect. Either for every day the man is outside the house, he owes his wife an exit. Something. Or something that opens the door for the possibility of a get.
So again, the question is, what's that something? If that something is this, so why? What is adding it to the ketubah? In fact, ketubah happens to be saying it's very questionable whether it will ever be enforceable in courts for two major reasons. One, the husband doesn't sign it. Therefore, doing it through the ketubah, besides issues, you know, of not tampering, will probably be less effective than this. I think the ultimate idea behind this is that if we really want to fix the problem, the way we should be fixing this is somehow getting this out of society. The fact that society has produced men and women who use these tactics really does not speak well of us. Right? The fact that people think this is normal, that this is something that's appropriate, that people go out and support them, shows that we're missing some real basics here. Yeah, we're playing catch-up. We're doing whatever we can to skirt it. But the truth of the matter, whoever's involved in education from the elementary school and up should be making it very clear that, you know, first you have to be a mensch. This is not the way a mensch is. This is not the way the people act. It's certainly not the way the Jewish people act. You know, it's not all about you. You know, it's about other people, including your children. And the bottom line is, the real tragedy behind this isn't, you know, how come the rabbis haven't found an answer to this? The real tragedy is that, you know, how can we have a society that provides these questions on such a regular basis? I think, you know, that's probably the takeaway thought about this. That, you know, it's a hard issue. People are working on it. They come up with different ways. This is case-by-case basis. You know, ideas like the prenuptial agreement is something that's trying to be done on a more global basis to shut it down. But the real underlying problem is something that we shouldn't forget either, and that's a real issue. Yes?
So I want to go back to the case of a man beats his wife. She won.
Okay. The question is now, what power does Mason have? Let's say they believe her 100%. Right? No doubt about it.
Police have been called, there are records, the whole bit. It's a given.
Right?
He doesn't want to give a get.
Right?
Yeah.
100%. Right? So what do we do now? So when Mason had real powers, Mason could do real things. There's a story of Rabbi Akiva Eger. It goes a little bit like this, that he had a situation where Akiva Eger was a great rabbi 250 years ago or so. And there was a guy who refused to give a get, right? not a good man. Called him in and said to him, listen, buddy, this is going to be a quick conversation. It says in the Mishnah and Kedushin, Ha'isha yotzeis v'shei drachim. There's two ways that a woman can go free from her husband. One is a get, the other is the death of the husband. You make the call. How do you want it to go down? The guy didn't survive the day. So, that works. Question is that Beis Din does not have that power nowadays. It's not a Beis Din, I can say unfortunately. Right? So therefore, we are left in a situation of, well, what's the next best we can do? And as we mentioned, we have issues here, what we can do. No? Obviously, in a case like that, where there's no doubt that, that maximum pressure should be put on, then yes, maximum pressure should be put on. Maximum pressure doesn't always work. That there's a part of this issue is...
But isn't that forcing? If you maximum pressure... I mean...
No, yeah, but that's a case if you're convinced that you're about to force.
I'm sorry.
So, right? So you're in what forcing means.
I'm just feeling like you're contradicting what you said earlier, which is two people come into a marriage agreeing and they go out of the marriage agreeing. So...
Right.
Back to that same issue
no,
about
this is a case
he doesn't
where,
want to give a get.
Right, but there's a right for a court order here. And there's certain cases where the court has a right to order, this is what you have to do. I mean, the bottom line is, the couple is married. The marriage is obviously not working. Right? Right? They're not living happily as husband and wife.
Right.
At that point, you know, it is reasonable for a Beis Din to determine that that's it. Listen, buddy, it's over. Move on. And therefore, they have a right to insist, as a Beis Din insists. It's an unfortunate fact of life that being that the Jewish community is so fractured, the power of the Beis Din becomes less. So again, when there was a time when we lived in the shtetl in Europe, right, or wherever our shtetl was, and there was one shul, and it was the community was all together, and if they said, listen, until you do this, we're not doing business with you, you're not coming in, that's it. You know, the guys, the pressure would be such where the guy would capitulate. Nowadays, you don't like me, I'll go across the street to the other shul. That's a big problem. So again, that's a case where yes, the Beis Din would allow maximum pressure. Maximum pressure ain't what it used to be. And people understand that maximum pressure doesn't mean snapping your fingers and announcing they're not married anymore. You can't do that. They're still married. You know, how can we avail ourselves, say, of the secular legal system, which obviously has a lot more power than we do, in a way that's still halachically permissible? That's basically where we find ourselves. Anything further? Thank you, Kaufman's.